chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them.
But we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
Our Netflix Christmas offering for you this week has a little bit of everything. It has blizzards that begin and end in the matter of a few minutes. It has a child's life in danger. It has charity towards the poor. It has the classic time-traveling night. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's the night before Christmas, and we're going to get into it.
You can thank our patrons on Patreon for choosing this garbage pile of a movie. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much. Janelle had not seen it before, so I really appreciate you guys making her watch this.
I wrote in my notes, I hate Netflix probably 12 times.
Guys, this movie is bad.
Yeah, it's like real bad. It's like, but it's like, and I can't decide whether it's bad in a way that it is aware of how bad it is. I think it is. I think it does know.
I know. Hope it's aware of how bad it is, because if a team of writers and producers and directors and everyone like genuinely thought this was a good movie, then I have some major concerns.
You're right, because it was probably like somebody in a Netflix boardroom was like, all right, let's throw darts at the wall to pick all of the titles for our Netflix movies, after which we'll write the screenplays. And definitely this was a title that someone put in a fishbowl. They're like, Night Before Christmas, we'll figure it out.
For sure. For sure. They were like, what if we did Night Before Christmas with a K? Someone get on that in case anyone's confused about what the premise of this movie, Knight Before Christmas, might be.
Knigget.
Janelle, do you want to read us the summary?
Unfortunately, yes, I will. The Night Before Christmas, the year of our Lord 2019, in the before times. Here's the plot summary. Brooke, played by Vanessa Hudgens, is a woman that has lost hope of finding her happily ever after and comes across Cole, played by Joss Whitehouse, a knight who has traveled from the 14th century. Cole has been sent into the future by an old crone to fulfill his destiny to become a true knight. After accidentally hitting him with her car, Brooke thinks that he is suffering from amnesia as he tells her that he is a knight. She wants to protect Cole, so she takes him in to help him until he regains his memory. What she doesn't realize is that he is the knight in shining armor that she's been wishing for all her life. Well, Eliza?
Oh my god.
So, that's what Wikipedia says this movie's about. But what's it really about? On a deeper level.
I mean, that is technically a description of the plot, but I feel like it misses a lot.
Take us there, Eliza.
This movie is about the fact that if you make a Christmas movie with a bunch of stuff that historically has been successful in romantic female-oriented movies, people will watch it, regardless of if those things are combined in any logical manner.
Yes, it definitely feels like an assignment you would get in your MFA in screenwriting class. They would be like, all right, pull three things from a hat. You got rom-com, medieval knights, and Christmas. Go.
Oh, for sure. And then they were like, what are other things that sometimes are in these kinds of movies? Okay, what if there is a, you know, precocious child who immediately likes the love interest and he's kind to her and therefore people will like the love interest? All right, let's throw that in there. What if there's a family in need? Okay, let's throw that in there. What if there is a big event on Christmas Eve that is a town community oriented thing and also doubles as a charity thing? Okay, throw that in there. And then someone in the writer's room was like, do we have to explain what kind of a charity this is for, where the money is coming from, or what it's being raised for? And they were like, no, we don't have to do that. Okay, so we're going to establish that this event was started by the protagonist in honor of her parents, but she's not going to be involved in any of the running of it. Yeah, that's fine. Like, none of the elements have to do with each other. And then there's this whole, like, magical element that nobody questions the whole movie.
Yeah, like, you can watch the look on the old crone, who is the person who, you know, starts this magic for our Sir Cole, which we'll get into Sir Cole in a bit. Yeah, you can watch the crone's face and see her trying not to laugh as she says her lines, because what they ask her to say is so nonsensical. And I mean, I'm even saying for like Netflix rom-com standards, it's nonsensical. Like, she's literally like, I am going to send you on a quest. He's like, what quest? She's like, don't worry about it. You're going to become a true knight. He's like, what do you mean? I've already been knighted 6 years ago, which he says later in the plot. She's like, don't worry about it. She's like, I'm going to help you find your destiny. And he says, what's my destiny? She says, don't worry about it. It'll be right in front of you when you open your eyes. None of it matters. It doesn't matter. The only thing is that it's a knight. That's the important thing. Yes, and he gets to the future.
And apparently all knights become true knights when they fulfill their quest. This is a historically accurate thing, obviously.
Which is so confusing because part of the plot revolves around him wanting to get back to Norwich Castle in the 14th century to see his brother in his own knighting ceremony. But is he saying that his brother is going to be knighted, but he won't be like a true knight?
No, you're not a true knight until you've fulfilled the quest given to you by the old crone in the woods, Janelle.
What the fuck.
Also, I want to talk about the old crone for a second, because her character is literally the old crone. Like, that is her name. That is how she's referred to. And in his quest to find the old crone to get answers about all of the weird shit she said to him before sending him 685 years into the future, the knight keeps stopping other older women on the street and being like, old crone! I just kept thinking, like, this is your option if you're a woman in these movies over the age of 30. Like, you can either play Mrs. Claus or the old crone. So, Candace Cameron Bure, get excited about your future.
And the best part about what you just said, Eliza, is that the old crone is Mrs. Claus at various points of the film. So they even, like, are self-aware of that in a weird way.
Right.
Like,
and, like, her old lady makeup is not good. Like, this woman's probably 42. No. I mean, she's not an old woman.
Yes. This movie, so, like, what's weird about this movie is that most of these rom-coms, at least, like, but I guess Netflix rom-coms so far have actually, like, not even tried to be about this, but usually rom-coms have some kind of, like, lesson in the end about, like, true love and dating and what's mm-hmm. important. And ostensibly, if you listen to the description of the plot of this film, the idea is that Vanessa Hudgens' character is, like, burnt out on love and she doesn't believe in love, and but also she's been waiting for a knight in shining armor her whole life. Which literally doesn't make sense. And at various points in the film, she takes different, like, stands on this. Mm-hmm. She tells a student of hers, she's a teacher who's a high schooler, that
she's a teacher who should never be allowed to speak to students.
Yeah, by the way, what she did is totally a violation of so many laws if you're a teacher. Like, you cannot talk to your high schoolers about their personal romantic lives in a closed room. Like, absolutely.
Also, just the way she talks to them, I was just like, this is bad adulting. Like, she gives this high schooler, the high schooler basically does bad on a test because she, like, just got broken up with by her boyfriend. And then this young teacher who she looks up to and admires says to her, you know, we all grow up wanting a knight in shining armor, but true love isn't real, so you should stop trying for it. Like, to, like, a 15-year-old girl.
It's so horrifying. And then later, at the end of the film, after she falls in love with Sir Cole or whatever, get this, listeners, she tells this poor girl who comes to her and is like, I followed your advice and I'm focusing on myself and my own goals now, even though my boyfriend, my ex-boyfriend, told me he wants me back. Aren't you proud of me for doing this great feminist thing? And Vanessa Hudgens' character says, no, true love is real. Knights are real. Follow your dreams. Find your love. And this poor girl's looking at her like, okay.
Right, like, she's like, get back away with your shitty ex-boyfriend.
She is confused. This poor girl who was just trying to, like, self-actualize. She has harmed this child.
Oh my
Vanessa
God.
Vanessa Hudgens harmed this child.
It's so bad. Also, like, Vanessa Hudgens, who is becoming, you know, the Netflix Christmas golden girl, is a very talented woman. She's a talented actress, a talented singer, and mm-hmm. you can watch her acting get steadily worse over the course of this movie.
Like, absolutely.
I feel like by the final scene where she, like, surprise, reunites with Sir Cole, she's not even trying. It's, like, the worst acting I've ever seen from Vanessa Hudgens.
And I felt like my favorite example of this is of her, like, phoning it in at various points, is that early on in the film, she takes her niece to the Christmas castle, something every town should have, and they're talking about what her niece wants for Christmas, and her niece says, I want a puppy, and Vanessa Hudgens' character literally says, a puppy, and then they just go off screen. Like, there's no acting choice in that. She just said the line, and I love it.
Also, okay, since you bring up the puppy, to fast forward to the end of this movie, guys, we're gonna jump around a little bit because it's so wild, I don't even know where to begin, but to fast forward to the end of this movie, this little girl wants a puppy, and her mom is like, puppies are a big responsibility. No. And then at the end of the movie, Christmas morning, the little girl has a puppy, and her parents, both look at each other and are like, did you get this puppy? No. Did you get this puppy? No. Then they run into Vanessa Hudgens and they're like, did you get your niece, our daughter, a puppy without asking us? And she says, no. And that's it. They accept it. They have a puppy now. The movie does not explain what magic gave this child a puppy, why her parents are suddenly okay with her having a puppy, why they're not freaked out that a random dog is in their home.
I think I decided at that moment that it must have been the old crone, and here's why. The only reason the old crone can actually work as a character is if you assume that she is this mischievous, mildly evil fae character who right. just, like, wants to start chaos wherever she goes. Because she asks Sir Cole in the beginning of the movie when they first meet in the woods after he's, like, searching for a falcon, a Christmas falcon, which is great. she says, like, won't you help a woman like me? And of course, this is a great opportunity for the film to, like, play on old fairy tales and have him be like, no, crone, I'm too busy. I'm looking for a falcon. But instead he's like, no, of course, I'll help you. And then she's like, great, I'm sending you into the future. Ba-ba-ba-boo. So I just feel like she does stuff, you know, she travels through time and then she does stuff. There's no reason. She just does it because that's how the fae be sometimes.
Right. Like, I feel like she's supposed to be like Rowan Atkinson in Love Actually, where she just like keeps appearing in random places, even though they're unrelated. And she's like, you know, the Christmas angel or the Christmas guardian or the Christmas witch, whatever, you know, who's like overseeing everything. Except that you have to write that into the story yourself. It's not true in the movie. It's implied, but like she's not, like, ever present. You don't see her, like, smiling outside of the window when the puppy appears, or ever see her interact with the little girl. There just, like, is a puppy, which is not how, you know, writing works.
No.
There's no narrative structure to this movie.
But let's assume that there was a version of this screenplay that could have been, that had structure. And if it did, I think one of the things that it would be trying to talk about is this, like, romantic notion of your knight in shining armor. Mm-hmm. And we should talk about that, Eliza, like, have you ever been a knight in shining armor girl? I've never been, but maybe you have.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, like, as a kid, I definitely, like, played dress up and pretended to be a princess or, you know, things like that. And I don't dislike royal narratives. You know, I love me some Princess Diaries or, you know, The Prince and Me, whatever, right? Like, I'm not against it, but I certainly was not, like, a princess girl in the same way. But I definitely have never been drawn to an adult narrative about needing a knight in shining armor. Like, I feel like even those examples that I just gave are the whole point of the story is the girl, like, saves herself. You know, I can't think of any princessy movie or knight movie or Renaissance or medieval story or whatever that I like where it's actually, like, the guy riding in to save the day.
Yeah, it's, like, so quietly regressive, this movie. Like, a lot of these rom-coms we look at are quietly regressive, but this one is especially, that it just, like, right. does not even sort of address the misogyny, the inherent patriarchal nature of what a knight represents. Like, for example, there's this brief scene where Sir Cole is talking to Brooke and her niece, and her niece asks, well, can girls be knights? And Sir Cole, of course, says, no. And Brooke says, yes, girls can be whatever they want. And then Cole's just like, okay, instead of doing what a knight would have done, which would be, that's an insult to the idea of a knight. How dare you? Knights are men. And they just, like, dropped it.
Right. Or even without having him be, like, that kind of a guy, he could have been like, no, actually, like, according to the laws of my land, a woman can't be a knight. Right. Like, he's answering the question, which was asked, but he never, like, continues on it. And it is, I feel like it stands out, especially in this movie, that kind of regressive gender politics, because even though that's present in a lot of these Christmas rom-coms, because they're movies that are so geared towards women, they are made for women to consume. I do feel like a lot of times you do get, you know, quote unquote, strong female characters because like they have female leads and the female audience watching the movie is supposed to identify with the female leads. So there's still a sort of, you know, very traditional gender relationship politics happening because, you know, they're almost always about like a very heteronormative couple. You don't always get like truly a woman who like needs to be saved. Like a lot of times, like she's saving her farm and then the guy helps or something like right. that. And this movie is not that. This knight just straight up shows up and like saves the little girl and inspires everyone in the town to be kind and teaches Vanessa Hudgens the true meaning of Christmas or whatever the hell happens, because she seems to already be super into Christmas, so I don't really think she needs him to do that, but I think that's what happens. And, like, there's no moment where you feel like she just figured it out on her own and he happened to be there.
Right, exactly. It's just such a... The whole narrative arc of the film is her getting slapped on the wrist for earlier saying that, you know, knights in shining armor are a fantasy and true love isn't real. And that is so gross.
Yeah, no, it's really...
On a narrative level.
And there's a whole thing about her, like, ex-boyfriend, like, really did a number on her... Which, kill me.
Which gets brought up and dropped almost immediately.
Right. Yeah. But, like, Sir Cole, the knight from the 14th century, who has a learning curve that's truly astounding when it comes to getting used to the 21st century, immediately picks up on the fact that her breakup really ruined her, you know, her self-esteem. And you're like, how did he pick up on that? He's from the 14th fucking century. He doesn't even understand what an ex-boyfriend is. And within three scenes, he's like, yeah, I know he really did a number on you. And you're like, what the fuck is happening here?
I know, I kept thinking about that. I was like, okay, first of all, a medieval would have no concept of what a boyfriend is to start with,
no.
As you said. They certainly wouldn't have any concept of what an ex-boyfriend would be. And for sure, the idea of cheating would be very confusing outside of the bounds of marriage. I mean, that just, like, would not be a concept that would have any cogency.
No, and it's clear, like, it's definitely clear there were multiple writers on this, because there are moments where you can see them starting to inch their way towards a more logical element of him not understanding things in the modern time, but they never actually explore it, and frequently it goes in the other direction where he understands things far more than he should. Like, there's this moment many scenes after they've actually talked about the boyfriend when he says, like, you know, if he has broken a betrothal and ruined you, then I will, you know, go fight him or whatever. Mm-hmm. And she's just like, no, it was for the best. And I'm watching it thinking, no, you have to explain to him that your boyfriend breaking up with you has not ruined you. Like, what he's saying is, if this man was promised to you and has slept with you, you're now a ruined woman and cannot be married, and you need to reassure him that's not what's happening anymore. But they don't. She's just like, no, the breakup was for the best, and he accepts that. And you're like, he just said that he doesn't understand how this process works. And then a scene later, he says, you know, the affairs of the heart are much more complicated in this day than romance was in my time. And she goes, yeah, I wish it was like in your time.
I screamed aloud when I heard that. Really,
oh,
Netflix?
God.
I hate you so much. Like, dare you?
I wish romance was still the way it was in chivalrous 14th century England, when a woman was married off for the benefit of her family by the age of 15.
Okay, and so hear me out. There is a version of this script that is rated R that I would love to read, where Sir Cole has a better name, a more realistic 14th century Englishman's name.
Yeah, gonna get back to that in a second.
Yes, we'll talk about all the historical inaccuracies, because that's fun. I want to see the version of this that's rated R, where Sir Cole is, like, a much more realistic portrayal of a medieval knight. So, like, he smells bad, his teeth are awful, he's like a 17-year-old whose wife has already died and he has three children, and he also talks, like, real gruff. It would be great. I would love to see it. And he's, like, covered in scars from all of the jousting he's done. Like, that is a version of this that I would love to see, and how, like, she, as a modern woman, would be like, no, 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 no. Your chivalry, quote-unquote, is not welcome here. I'm going to turn you into a modern man. So instead of him turning her back to chivalry, she's saying, like, no, dude, that sucks. Let's do modern romance instead. That is the script I want. Someone get on it.
Yeah, agreed. And they, like, start to have sex, and he's like, oh, no, 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 I couldn't do that, not until we are married. And she's like, okay, dude, no.
And she's like, shut up.
Oh my god, the chaste, terrible kisses in this movie.
Awful. Just horrible.
Awful. Okay, let's talk about the historical inaccuracies for a moment.
Yes.
I'm gonna begin. To be clear, the movie starts in Norwich, England, on December 18th, 1334. Mm-hmm. So 14th century, solidly medieval time period. We are not at the Renaissance yet. We are, you know, very sort of medieval England. The time jump is 685 years. Very unclear why. Like, I feel like they could have picked a random year in historical England that would mean he jumped like 500 years exactly or something, but they didn't do that. Mm-hmm. The knight's name is Sir Cole. Cole, C-O-L-E. I had to look this up because I was like, there's no way that was a common name in 14th century England. Cole, as a first name, did not appear in America, at least, and therefore I'm assuming in England as well, based on my research, until the late 19th century. About the 1880s, coal started to appear. You start to get famous people like Cole Porter, who was born in, I believe, the 1890s. Until then, coal was only a last name or a derivation of a last name, such as a few Scottish and Irish names like McCool. And occasionally, coal appears in writing as a nickname for the name Nicholas. And so if the only option for him having the first name Coal in this time period is him being Nicholas, his name is Nicholas, then why is he introducing himself as Sir Coal? Because you wouldn't use your informal name when introducing yourself. And Coal did not reach popularity in America, at least, until the 1990s. So we just have given him the most, like, middle America white boy name we could think of and then added Sir in front of it. And now he's an English knight.
And it's so annoying because the English crown had these names that have persisted until now. Like, they could have called him Henry or Edward. That would have been fine. Why not that? Why does it have to be Cole?
Or giving him, like, a fun old-fashioned name, right? Like, if the whole point is that he keeps standing out as being not of this time, give him some, like, Lancelot-style old-fashioned, give him some, like, Welch name, like, that just comes out of nowhere and doesn't sound like it fits in this time. And then she, like, gives him a fun nickname that sounds more normal. There's so many options.
I know. That's the thing about this movie that's so frustrating is that, like, if they wanted to lean really hard into the historical details, they could have, and it would have been so much fun. Like, I am a huge nerd. I would have loved that so much. But instead, they went into this, like, middle ground space where they have enough identifying details. Like, they tell you he was knighted by King Edward III. They tell you that he's at Norwich Castle. They, you know, they explain some of the Christmas traditions in that medieval period, although they're not quite right in their dating, so I'm not sure what happened with all that. They certainly didn't have Christmas trees in 1334.
Oh my god. Guys, he starts telling her the proper way to decorate a Christmas tree. He's from fucking 1334. Christmas trees did not appear in England until 1840.
Come on, guys.
Like, there's a German tradition, which I think even in Germany wasn't really around in 1334, but it didn't transfer to England until the time of Queen Victoria, which is not a hard detail to Google.
But the thing that he says about getting, like, an orange and a halfpenny, like, that's legit. Right. That's what's so annoying. Like, he's like, we had a Christmas tree. Wrong. But I got an orange and a halfpenny. That's right, somehow.
That sounds kind of right. And, like, it may not be the exact tradition in Norwich, England, but it was a tradition around that time in parts of England. And, you know, certainly the halfpenny being part of the Christmas tradition is quite common. You see it appear in songs, you see it appear in various stories, and something like an orange would have been a very special and expensive gift because they don't grow around there certainly most of the year, and definitely not in December, right? Like, there's reasons for that. And again, a simple Google search will give this to you. I'm not asking you to do deep scholarly medieval research.
Although when you do get into it, some of the things that they put forward as the truth are actually kind of hilarious. Like, for example, if we follow the timing that Sir Cole says that he was knighted upon, he says he was knighted 6 years ago when he was 21. That means that he would have been knighted by King Edward III the year after he was coronated, which would mean he was 16. So he got knighted by this, like, 16-year-old boy, which is hilarious to imagine. But also what I learned doing some research is that Norwich Castle, where he professes to be hanging out, which I found very suspicious because I was like, I don't actually think that knights would be hanging out in a northern principality if they were knighted by the king. That seems really unlikely. But what I researched instead was that Norwich Castle at this time was a straight up jail, y'all. It had been a jail since 1210. It was a jail.
Well, and they go out of their way to explain that he's not aristocracy, right? Like, right. He explains that, like, his mother was a seamstress and his father was a baker or something. Like, there's a whole thing. They make it very clear that, like, he got a position as a squire and then worked his way up, like, which is a thing that can happen. But doing that, you don't, like, work your way up to lord. You work your way up to knight, and that's where you stop, right? And so it's very clear he's not, like, a wealthy cousin of the prince or something. He's just a normal person, but whose job is knight. But then, like, why is he hanging out at a castle? Why is he hanging out at a castle that's actually a jail? Why is he, like, acting as if he's a member of the aristocracy at times? But then, like, these people don't know what a knight is, and it's so glaringly obvious.
Well, and especially because, and right now I want to give a shout out to the two academics who trained me in theater history, and they are Dr. Franklin J. Hilde and Dr. Esther Kim Lee, and I'm so sorry because I'm sure I'm going to say some things that are wrong right now, but I'm fairly certain that one of the weirder things about this has to do with a larger misconception about knights in general and chivalry mm-hmm. in general, which is that our perception of knights tends to come from the myths of the Knights of the Round Table, mm-hmm. most of which were written down in the 15th and 16th centuries, but some of which were written down in the 14th century, which is where, of course, Sir Cole is coming from. But they were writing about a time that was at least 200 years before their own. And really, mm-hmm. The historic King Arthur was in the 5th and 6th centuries, they're fairly certain, if he did indeed exist. That's a bit of a question. So it's really interesting that, like, this film is professing to portray an era of English history that was, like, you know, rotten with knights, but I don't actually know that it was. I think knighthood and chivalry was very different by the 14th century than we think of it. By then, it was the stuff of the, you know, romances and tales.
Right. Yeah. No, our contemporary understanding of knights is so interesting because it's a bastardization of, essentially, a bastardization of a historical fact, right? Like, you get this, you know, beginning, you know, in whatever, like the, you know, 500s, a possible historical King Arthur, or at least stories of a historical King Arthur, that then starts to become legendary and really be talked about as, you know, accepted country historical myth. And then by the 18 and 1900s, it starts to be rewritten. And those are the versions of knights that we now base things on, is that, like, 20th century understanding of the Arthurian legend from the 16th century, which is about the 12th century, you know, right? Yeah. I mean, it's
it's a lot, like, of translation.
It has nothing to do with what knighthood actually was, which was, you know, a system of running a military for small local regions, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. what it was. And there was a chivalric code, which at various times was or wasn't followed to different extents. But, like, our understanding that all knights were just there to save the princess is, like, so far off from anything.
Well, and yeah, and that's how you know that it's, like, this weird patriarchal propaganda, is that our notion of a knight in shining armor, quote unquote, has actually nothing to do with historical knights, really. I mean, we have some vague understanding of what the chivalric code was, but it didn't have as much to do with romance and love as you would think, and certainly not as much as this film seems to think, since at the end says that to be a true knight you have to find love, which they didn't even understand that when they wrote it. No one knows what that means.
No one knows what that means. But yeah, anyone who thinks, like, chivalry is dead because men no longer open car doors for women, like, nope. The chivalric code was about, like, following the word of God, following, you know, the Lord that you paid your taxes to, and being honorable in life and death, right? Like, it was not about just, like, being polite to women.
But being polite to women was a product of it, but it wasn't, like, rule number one. It was just part of being an honorable dude who goes around the countryside and, like, helps people. That was it. Although I did look up that King Edward III, so maybe this is how they got to putting it at this time, I don't know why, but King Edward III actually, he founded the most noble order of the Garter, yes. But what's interesting about that is that I went and I was looking at some renderings and marginalia they have about that order, and y'all, the knights from this period, the way that they actually were portrayed in the period, as opposed to what we see Sir Cole wearing with just, like, the chainmail and the battle armor, which he wore to go find a falcon, I just want to say again. Why?
No.
We'll never know. But the actual knights in the medieval period wore, like, hilarious poofy hats with feathers and, like, stockings, you know? Right. Like, they did not go around in armor as much as we like to believe that. So it's just kind of funny to reimagine, like I said, a version of this that's more historically accurate where Cole is wearing a poofy hat.
Right. Like, he definitely should be in a poofy hat and then, like, leathers and furs. Because honestly, like, a good leather vest is really all you need to stop a poorly made sword.
Yep.
And if he's, like, a country knight who's fighting other country knights, like, he's not going up against the world's finest steel here.
Yeah.
I also, the other thing that drove me crazy about the writing for this is that, in addition to, like, not doing, like, their historical research, just the, like, internal logic of how this historical character responds to the modern world, the contemporary mm-hmm. world, was so all over the place and wild to me. Like, they kept having him learn modern technology very quickly. Like, they get in the car and she turns on music and he's completely shocked and wondering where the minstrels are. Okay, fine. But then he's like, can I try? And starts pressing the buttons, understanding that's going to change the channel to different music. Like, why would he understand that? She teaches him how to use Alexa by saying, Alexa, play Christmas carols once. And then he just, like, understands that he can ask Alexa questions, which is not actually a logical thought process, right? Like, we only know that because we live in the modern world. My parents live in the modern world and they can barely figure out how to use Alexa. Like, why can this knight start playing all these different Christmas songs? And then the one that drove me absolutely fucking bonkers, they get there to the modern world and she almost hits him with her car. She gets out of the car and, you know, they deal with all this. And he starts referring to the car as her steel horse.
Oh my God.
Like, what creature on God's green earth would see a car for the first time in their lives and think, that's like a horse, but made of steel? Carriages existed in the 14th century, ladies and gentlemen. He might be like, why do you have a horseless carriage? Or if she'd pulled up on a motorcycle, maybe then he'd be like, that's a weird looking horse, because like bicycles haven't been invented yet. But you wouldn't look at a fucking SUV and think, that's just like a horse.
No, not at all. And like, it's funny because there's like, okay, so on the one hand, this film deeply, deeply underestimates how creative medievals were, because if you've ever looked at medieval marginalia, and I know you have, Eliza, because we have talked about this at length.
I love me some medieval marginalia.
It's some good stuff. He would have come up with some, like, wild explanation for what this car was. Yeah, he could have come up with it as a carriage. He could have thought it was a lion. That's a fun joke for anyone who knows about medieval lions.
Right, like, I think it'd be much more likely that he'd be like, that is a dragon that had eaten you, than be like, that's your steel horse. Because in order to get to steel horse, you have to have an understanding of the function and makeup of a car. You have to know that people stopped using horses because we started having automobiles. You wouldn't make the jump just by seeing the two things.
But you know what I found funny, though, is that there's one moment where, you know, and I actually, like, the medieval period is one of my pet theater history areas. I, like, love it. And
in case you couldn't tell.
And one of the areas where they actually get the medieval state of mind correct, I think, is there's a scene where Cole is talking to Brooke about time travel. And he's like, well, yes, you know, time travel, that happens. Like, I have to believe that that happens, that the sun rises and it sets and I can't explain any of it. So why not? Why not time travel? Nothing else makes sense to me. And Brooke's like, oh, that's so sweet. But internally, I was thinking like, yeah, but that's true. That's definitely what medievals believed. Their sense of time was so different from ours. Like,
absolutely.
Any given medieval at this time, if you ask them about Jesus Christ, they would talk about Jesus as if he was currently living. Like, they could recognize that he was dead, but they could also, like, conceptualize that Jesus could appear before them at any time. So any person they met on the road could be Jesus Christ, because that's just how they thought about time. It was such a different mindset than we have now.
Well, and even the understanding of magic was different. Like, we're not even talking about, like, magic is bad according to Christianity, witch trial type period. Like, that's still several hundred years later. This is still a time period where in a lot of places there's still sort of pagan, Celtic kind of old world versions of magic still being practiced, or at least still sort of influencing the local mythologies and things like that. Their understanding of magic as is being done by God and by Jesus was different. You know, these are people whose lives were ruled every day by birth and death being imminent possibilities, right? Like, the plague is starting to spread. A lot of, you know, most families have children who didn't live past infancy, right? Like, the concepts of a full lifespan and of science and all of that, as we think of them, like, didn't really influence these people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that some old woman in the woods could just, like, throw you into the future probably wouldn't seem any crazier than anything else.
No, you'd be like, yeah, sounds legit. Like,
right, like, that makes as much sense as me dying because I got a small wound on my arm. Like,
absolutely. Medievals didn't seek out explanations the way that we do. They didn't have the same sense of, like, the difference between, I mean, this makes it seem like they didn't have a sense of the difference between reality and mythology, but in a sense, they didn't. I mean, they thought functionally, like, they more or less the same things. Hold on. Speaking about the difference between reality and mythology, can we talk about the Netflix Christmas cinematic universe?
Oh boy, we need to cover this because it is on full display in this movie. In fact, I think this might be the movie that first caused people to start referring to it that way, because this movie has a reference to not one, not two, but three unrelated Netflix Christmas movies. Two references, they watch the movies in real time in this movie. One reference, they refer to a movie as if it actually happened.
I have so many questions. I mean, I guess that those, like, in those moments, you sit and you realize, like, oh yeah, this is where they're telegraphing to us, like, don't take any of this seriously. Like, we don't care about the internal logic of this film and this world, and neither should you.
Right. For those who aren't as familiar as we are with the concept of the Netflix Christmas Cinematic Universe, or the NCCU, as I will be referring to it, there are, as I'm sure you know, a whole crop of Netflix Christmas rom-coms that have come out over the last, like, 4 years. And many of them refer to each other in one form or another within their own movies. And part of this is just, you know, internal advertising, right? Like, if you're going to go watch A Christmas Prince, and then you see, you know, them mention watching A Night Before Christmas, you're like, oh, maybe I'll watch that next. But it's done in a way that is so much more complicated than that. Because in this movie, in A Night Before Christmas, they are at one point watching Holiday in the Wild, which is the one with Rob Lowe where they go to Africa and save the elephants or something like that. And then at another point are watching The Holiday Calendar, which is one of the few non-white-led Netflix Christmas movies. And then there is a reference to Andovia, whatever it is, the Christmas Prince country, and the acorn Christmas ornament, which features in the plot of A Christmas Prince. So the other two movies are Netflix movies within the universe of A Night Before Christmas, but A Christmas Prince is a story that actually took place in the same universe as A Night Before Christmas. And even more wild than that, in the Christmas Prince movies, in the third one, there are references to curses and magic, which do not exist in the previous two. But because we've established that that world exists in the same world as this, we can accept that there's magic in the Christmas Prince world because there's magic in the Night Before Christmas world.
Which made me so angry because I was thinking about all of that. When you get to the end of The Night Before Christmas, there's a kind of post-credits or mid-credits scene where it sets up a sequel where Sir Cole's brother, who's just been knighted, is being sent off into the future by the crone. And I was like, these jerks are going to make a fourth Christmas Prince, and this fucking knight is going to somehow be that prince. And I'm going to be so mad. I'm going to be so vengeful.
Well, and on top of all of that, the Princess Switch movies, which are also NCCU movies, and also star Vanessa Hudgens, also make reference to the country of Aldovia, and therefore must exist in this same universe as Christmas Prince and Night Before Christmas. Except in the Princess Switch movies, we now have three established women who are all played by and look like Vanessa Hudgens. But if Night Before Christmas also exists in that universe, we have four established women played by and looking like Vanessa Hudgens.
So it's an Orphan Black situation where Brooke is just one of these, like, many twins? Is that what's
going
to happen?
You know what? Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe they're all freaking clones of each other.
I hope you're not listening to this, Netflix, because please don't.
And all of these clones have had the spirit of Christmas removed from their brains and so must have handsome men reinstill it in them.
The worst part, Eliza, is I just thought of a title for what this movie would be.
Hotel. Yes.
I'll be cloned for Christmas.
Oh, no! I am so excited for that. 2021, here we come.
Oh, no.
I'll be cloned for Christmas. The campaign starts tomorrow. I know that getting pedantic about a movie this dumb and simple is stupid, but it's hard to not get pedantic when you're watching it and literally every line makes you go, what?
Well, and it worries me as a cultural critic, I have to be honest, that now there's so much cultural product out there that is referential to the fact that people are going to be having these sorts of conversations about it. Like, they made this movie, just like Christmas Prince, to be talked about in exactly the way we're talking about it now,
mm-hmm.
because they know exactly what kind of entertainment we're looking for. So it makes me very scared about, like, I don't know, like, what's going to come after this when this becomes just, like, normal entertainment? Like, this becomes the standard bearer?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for those of you who remember when Christmas Prince first came out, and it was, like, the first one of these that was available for streaming, and that was, like, just a truly terrible plot and really low quality production value. And Netflix tweeted out that tweet about, like, to the 52 of you who have watched this every day in December, what's wrong with you? Or are you okay? Whatever it was. Like, they're establishing, we know this movie is bad. And we know the hype around it is everyone talking about how bad it is. And we're going to participate in that hype in order to expand it. And now they've made a dozen or so, maybe two dozen at this point, movies like that, knowing the discourse is this. And yet here we are watching them.
I feel like somewhere Aldous Huxley, who predicted in Brave New World that what would destroy us as a civilization was entertainment, is rolling around in his grave, because he was right.
Called it.
So before we try and come up with some kind of antidote to this terrible film, we always like to thank our patrons on Patreon, and specifically our romantic leads who keep the show going. They are Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey. Man, what would we do without you? Damsels in distress. That's mm-hmm. all we'd be.
Yeah, they're definitely our knights in shining armor, and mm-hmm. also just very, very excellent supporters. If you want to become a patron, you can for as little as $1 a month, and you can get access to all kinds of cool stuff, including probably several outtakes from this episode, and our newsletter, which will have some of our other research on the medieval period and knights in general. So if you're curious about that, go check out our Patreon.
So, Eliza, my God. There is not enough time, there is not enough tape, there is not enough bandwidth to talk about all the things that are wrong with this movie. So let's come up with some solutions. What are your antidotes this week?
So I was all over the place trying to think of antidotes for this, but ultimately I think I'm going to kind of focus on the whole medieval aspect here. If you're looking for something that has more of the medieval vibe, but in less of a head-scratchy kind of way, I've got a couple suggestions for you. The first... if you're looking for some medieval Christmas fun, watch the movie The Lion in Winter from 1968. This is based on a play, so you can also read the play. And the movie stars Peter O'Toole as Henry II and Katharine Hepburn as Eleanor of Aquitaine. She won her third Oscar for her performance in this role, which at the time was the most Oscars ever won by a single actor. And the movie takes place at Christmas time in the 12th century. And it is about Henry II and his estranged wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, fighting over which of their four sons should succeed to the throne upon Henry's death. And it's obviously not historically accurate completely. You know, it's a movie, it's fictional, it's, you know, based on what we think may have happened. But the depictions of living in the medieval period are much more on point. They're in a, like, big drafty castle. There's accurate descriptions of how long it takes to, like, travel between places. There's, you know, accurate discussions of the wars that are happening at the time, that kind of stuff. And it's a really wonderful piece with some powerhouse performances. It's a drama, but it's also very funny. You know, Katharine Hepburn just turns out a star performance. She's really wonderful. The two of them just bicker through the whole thing. It has one of my favorite lines from a Christmas movie, which is, "Shall we hang the holly or each other?" And it's really fun. And Eleanor of Aquitaine in general is a really fascinating person. And her children, her oldest son, Richard, became Richard the Lionheart. Her youngest son, John, became the reason the Magna Carta was written and signed. So, like, there's a lot happening with that family. And The Lion in Winter is just a great movie. The other thing, if you're curious about some more accurate, you know, historical stuff about the medieval period, there is a series that I believe was made for the BBC, but which is now available on YouTube, called Medieval Lives, Birth, Marriage, and Death. And it's a 3-episode series. One episode talks about the concept of birth in the medieval times, one episode talks about the concept of marriage, and one episode talks about the concept of death. And they talk about how they were viewed from a religious standpoint at the time. They talk about the, you know, the physical realities, who was in the room when a baby was being born, how did marriages happen legally, all that kind of stuff. And it's actually a really fascinating series, because it's a lot of stuff that we just take for granted now that really was thought about and operated differently in the medieval period. So it's really interesting if you're curious.
I love all of that, of course, because yes, you should definitely, whatever you know about the medieval period, you should know more. And I'm going to keep that going. This isn't exactly about the medieval period, but you know, part of my interest in an R-rated version of this film that's more historically accurate would include what's called original pronunciation. The original pronunciation project is this linguistic kind of style, this project, this kind of thing that they do with Shakespeare a lot, that was started by the linguist David Crystal and his son Ben Crystal, who's an actor. And essentially it's a project that tries to recreate how Shakespeare's works were pronounced in their time And spoiler alert, it was pretty different from the way that we speak English now.
Oh, yeah.
So we're talking about an English that is distinctly of the early modern period. So we're talking like probably something that represents like 1550 to 1650. So we're talking 200 years after the events of Night Before Christmas. But so go to their website, originalpronunciation.com. Watch some of the videos and examples of OP, as they call it, and imagine that, but like an even weirder, even earlier, like older English version of that, and just like take in how it forces you to have this guttural, this like deeper register pronunciation of your voice, and try and tell me that wouldn't be like way sexier in my R-rated version of this movie. That's the original pronunciation project.
Of course, that's where your brain goes.
Duh. But finally, and on a more like serious recommendation note, I mean, the original pronunciation project is cool. Go look at it. I want to recommend one of my favorite offbeat Christmas movies that is a classic fish out of water romance, and that is the 1990 Tim Burton classic Edward Scissorhands, which, if you're not familiar, is about a strange man who has scissors for hands, being kind of adopted by the Southern California family at Christmas time, and his sort of very childlike love for their daughter. It's very sweet. It's very moving. It's very much about being in a place where you don't belong and finding your own way. And I find it extremely romantic and very sweet. So, you know, go watch Edward Scissorhands. Egads, Eliza. We did it.
We got through A Night Before Christmas.
Huzzah.
Yeah. On a personal note, I was both excited and scared to rewatch this movie because I watched it last year for the first time with a group of girlfriends who all got together in my apartment, and like nine of us squashed onto a couch and a couple of chairs and got drunk and watched this movie, and it was so much fun. And thinking about that this year when I like can't see anyone, it's a little heartbreaking, but it also like I'm so glad that I got to do that. And watching these movies is so much fun when you can do it with friends. So even if you're like on Zoom or just texting your friends or whatever, do, you know, enjoy these movies when you watch them, because they are so ridiculous. You got to have fun with it.
Exactly. Enjoy them and then text with your friends furiously, as we did, about all the anachronisms, and have a blast.
Happy whatever you're celebrating right now. I think when this goes up, it'll still be Hanukkah for a day or two. So happy Hanukkah to those who celebrate. See you guys next week.
Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time. Instead of breaking up, let's start some kissing and making.